let's begin by recapping where we left off yesterday, just so that we remind ourselves of the story so far. In our travel through the story of what God is doing in the Bible, do come and sit on the front, by the way. You'll need to, I'll say to the others, you'll need to be able to see, and the print is getting very small today. In our story through the Bible, what we've seen is that at the beginning, God created the world. He created it with great power, and it was very good. And he ruled it and had a great relationship with Adam and Eve. All was superb in the Garden of Eden. Unfortunately, Adam and Eve then sinned and rebelled against God, and therefore God judged them, as we saw yesterday, by banishing them from the Garden of Eden. He turned hostile against them, he cursed them, he condemned them to die, and relationships between people were ruined. And things went from bad to worse, as you can see down there. So continue bumping along at the bottom. Until one day, God intervened and began his plan to reverse everything that went wrong at the fall. And he began his plan to reverse everything that went wrong at the fall by making promises to one man, Abraham. Now, there's something here that I didn't make, I think, as clear as I ought yesterday, so I want to make it really clear now because it's really quite important for us today. And that is that what God has promised Abraham, he is committed to doing regardless of anything that Abraham or his descendants do or don't do. This is an unconditional covenant. God has said, he has sworn an oath, he will do this. This reversal will take place come what may. By hook or by crook, he's going to find a way of accomplishing this. Now, that's really important to bear in mind. We will see why later on in this session. But also, we saw yesterday that these promises are promises for the future. Abraham, at this present moment, doesn't experience any of what God has promised. He doesn't have any of the land yet. He doesn't have any of the blessings yet. He doesn't have the descendants yet. All these things are still for the future, which is why at this point the diagram divides into the black bit, which represents what Abraham is actually experiencing, and the blue bit, which is what God has promised. So the blue line says God has promised that one day he will give Abraham this reversal of what's gone wrong. The black bit says Abraham at the present moment isn't experiencing it yet. Now, you can see from that how much of the story there's still to go. Because that blue bit isn't yet anywhere near what they lost at the fall. Canaan is not the Garden of Eden. There's still a long, long way back. So the promise that God has made is only the beginning of what he's going to promise to do. And as the story of the Bible unfolds, we're going to have to see how God's promises develop until he's promising a full reversal of everything that went wrong at the fall. Similarly, there's no point in God promising that he will do all this if the promises never ever get fulfilled. So somehow, God has to work in the life of Abraham's descendants in such a way that he rescues them from where they are at the present moment, to give them what he's promised. So that black line has to come up on the diagram until it touches the blue. Experience has to match the promise. And the promise has to... Whoops. Help, I get that straight. The promise has to reach the new creation, which is what God is eventually going to promise. But as we saw at the end of yesterday, God has made a really good start in beginning to make Abraham's descendants experience, match the promise, to rescue them from what they're experiencing for what he's promised at the Exodus. And at first, everything looks really quite good. They come out of Egypt, they go through the desert, and they come to Mount Sinai. And that's where we pick the story up again today. Just before we do that, one other just slight recap of yesterday is that everybody experienced the fall. Everybody. is now cursed. Everybody is going to die. Everybody sins. But the promise of some reversal is only for Abraham's descendants. Those are God's people, and those are the people we now need to keep our eye on. Okay, now let's take the story up from there. I'm afraid we're going to go slightly faster today than yesterday, because as I counted the pages in my Bible this morning, after breakfast, I realized that something like three quarters of the Bible happens between where we are so far and when Jesus comes. And we're going to cover most of that three quarters in the next hour or so. So, deep breath, fasten your safety belts, and should you get lost, do you just put your hand up and stop me and ask for clarification? Okay? Great. Let's take it from there. God now brings them to Mount Sinai, and at Mount Sinai, he makes the second covenant with them that he makes. A covenant which is called the Mosaic Covenant, because it is through Moses, the man who is currently leading them, that God is making this covenant. The Mosaic Covenant itself is huge. It starts in Exodus 19 and runs all the way through the whole of the rest of Exodus and the whole of the book of Leviticus and the whole of the book of Numbers and the whole of the book of Deuteronomy. Now, we're not going to look at all of that today, you'll be pleased to know. Fortunately, the Mosaic Covenant is summarized twice for us in those chapters. And the first of those summaries takes place in Leviticus 26. So let's look at Leviticus 26 just to see some of the sorts of things that God is promising to do in the Mosaic Covenant. And what we see is that, now as I said, it's getting smaller, it's going to get smaller still. If you're having difficulty, do move forward at any stage to fill some of the nice seats that are still vacant on the front row. Let's take that from the top and just begin to work down through the list of the Mosaic Covenant. The ones, the first two columns and the last column are exactly the same as what we saw yesterday. They're just there to remind you of what we saw yesterday. The one which matters, the new one, is the column marked Mosaic Covenant. Moses. Leviticus 26 then, what is promised in the Mosaic Covenant? Well, let me tell you the summary before we look at the detail. In summary, God re-promises in the Mosaic Covenant everything he promises to Abraham, plus one or two bits. So let's look at the re-promised first to see that all the things he's mentioned pop up again. In Leviticus 26, verses 9 to 12, we see God promising a relationship with himself, just as he'd promised a relationship with himself to Abraham, to counterbalance the fact that they'd lost that relationship, he turned hostile to them at the fall. Leviticus 26, verses 9 to 12, God says, I will look on you with favor. So instead of looking on them with hostility, he'll look on them with favor and make you fruitful and increase your numbers, and I will keep my covenant with you. You will still be eating last year's harvest when you have to move it out to make room for the new. I will put my dwelling place among you, and I will not abhor you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you will be my people. Okay? So he will walk with them. He will dwell with them. He will be their God. They will be his people. He will look on them with favor. He won't abhor them. So the relationship he's promising is the sorts of things that he was promising to Abraham. Similarly, if you remember, Adam and Eve were thrown out of the Garden of Eden. Abraham is promised the land. And if you look at 26 verse 5, the last bit of it, you'll see that land again is mentioned in the promise to Moses. Leviticus 26 verse 5, the last bit, you will eat all the food you want and live in safety in your land. God is going to give them the land, which is going to be their land, the place to live in. Similarly, the blessing gets mentioned in verses 4 to 6. Verse 4, I will send you rain in its season, and the ground will yield its crops, and the trees of the field their fruit. Your threshing will continue until the grape harvest, and the grape harvest will continue until planting, and you will eat all the food you want and live in safety in your land. I will grant peace in the land, and you will lie down, and no one will make you afraid. I will remove savage beasts from the land, and the sword will not pass through your land, through your country. So you see what God is doing? He's spelling out what those blessings are. Abram was promised just blessings. But now we're beginning to see what those blessings mean. Blessings are about having peace and about having prosperity. All the prosperity you want, all the food you want, it's all there. All the peace you want. There'll be no wild animals, there'll be no swords, there'll be nothing to make you frightened. There's the real sense of security that they had lost. Similarly, if you remember, Abram was promised many descendants. He'd have lots and lots of people to counteract the fact that Adam and Eve were told they would die. And here, if you look at verse, whatever it is, 9, you'll see the same thing promised. Verse 9, I'll look on you with favor and make you fruitful and increase your numbers. And finally, we saw that Abram was promised that he'd be a great nation, that'd be that idea of harmony, people living together safely. Now that's much less clear in this passage, but in verse 6, again, the fact there will be peace in the land implies harmony, because peace in the land doesn't just mean you won't have wild animals, so it certainly means that. It doesn't just mean that neighboring countries won't come and attack you, though it certainly means that. It also means that you won't be attacking each other. There'll be peace amongst the people of Israel. Okay? Does that make sense? Good. I'll take that as a yes. So all those things that were promised to Abraham that are needed to at least partly reverse what went wrong at the fall, all those are re-promised again to Moses, or to Israel through Moses. But the Mosaic covenant develops the Abrahamic covenant in two important ways. The first way is the promises to Moses go further and spell out and flesh out and explain and develop the promises to Abraham. So just look at what we've got up there on the chart, and you'll see that Abraham was told that God would be his God and his descendants' God. Now we actually see that that means that God will look with favor on them, and God will dwell with them, and God will walk with them. And that relationship that they'll have with him is one of the key things that is spelt out and developed in the Mosaic Covenant. It's really quite amazing when you think about it. You think God dwelling with you, yeah, okay, interesting, tick that one, let's move on. But we're talking about the God who made the whole universe, the God who with a word said, let there be, and all the stars in the sky came into being. The God who said, let there be, and every atom and every molecule and every bit of chemistry that you all know about and plants, and it all happened just like that. That God said, I will come and dwell with you, and I'll walk with you, and I'll be with you. So we're talking about that sort of a relationship, which is on offer. Okay? And other ways in which it's spelled out are things like, Abram is simply told he'll be blessed. Now we see what form that blessing is taking. It's taking the form of peace and prosperity. So do you see how the Mosaic Covenant is, at least in some way, not hugely perhaps, but in some significant ways, developing and certainly spelling out and fleshing out what is promised to Abraham? Even more importantly, however, is the other way in which the Mosaic Covenant develops the Abrahamic Covenant. And that is that the Mosaic Covenant now has conditions attached to it. Remember we said earlier on in the recap that Abram was promised that he would have what was promised come what may. Moses, and well, Israel through Moses, is not promised that. Look at Leviticus 26, verse 3. If you follow my decrees and are careful to obey my commands, then he'll do everything else that he says. If you follow my decrees and obey my commands. Look at another place where that comes also very clearly, where the whole Mosaic Covenant begins in Exodus 19. Yesterday, a couple of times, we were told that our theme verse for this conference is that verse in 1 Peter chapter 2, where Peter says, you are a chosen people, a holy nation, a royal priesthood. Well, what Peter is doing there is he's quoting a bit from Exodus 19, which I'm going to read to you. But in Exodus 19, as we'll see, it says, if you obey, then you will be a holy nation. Look at it. Exodus 19, verse 5 and 6, God says, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Really, very important that in the Mosaic Covenant, God is saying, you will get all these things. You will be a treasured possession for me. You will be my holy people. You'll be a kingdom of priests if you fully obey. And what happens if they don't fully obey? Well, if they don't fully obey, then God doesn't simply do nothing. God will actually do the opposite of all these good things he's promising. He will make things worse. He will continue to judge. Just as in the fall, in the first place, when they sinned, all these bad things happened. Well, God made all these bad things happen. He condemned them. He punished them with it. So now if they continue to sin, he will continue to punish them in all these ways. Let's just look at the other summary statement of the Mosaic Covenant to see that. If you want to look at the positive side of the Mosaic Covenant summarized, it comes clearest in Leviticus 26. If you want to see the negative side summarized, it comes clearest in Deuteronomy 28. So let's go to Deuteronomy 28 to just see that. Let's just start reading from verse 58 towards the end of Deuteronomy 28 to see the sorts of things that God says he will do if they don't obey. Verse 58. If you do not carefully follow all the words of the law which are written in this book and do not revere this glorious and awesome name, the Lord your God, the Lord will send fearful plagues on you and your descendants, harsh and prolonged disasters, and severe and lingering illness. He will bring upon you all the diseases of Egypt that you dreaded, and they will cling to you. The Lord will also bring on you every kind of sickness and disaster not recorded in this book of the law until you are destroyed. So you see God turning against them now again, cursing them, being hostile to them. Let's go on. Verse 62. You who are as numerous as the stars in the sky will be left but few in number, because you did not obey the Lord your God. Just as it pleased the Lord to make you prosper and increase in number, so it will please him to ruin and destroy you. So you see, they'll lose those many descendants that they've been promised. They'll all be destroyed. You'll be uprooted from the land you are entering to possess. Then the Lord will scatter you among all nations from one end of the earth to the other. So the land they're going into, that will be taken away from them as well. Keep going. There you will worship other gods, gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. So their relationship will go as well. Do you see how as we work through that passage, those just five verses or so, six verses in Deuteronomy 28, you see all those promises made, if they obey, are all reversed. They lose the relationship, they lose the blessing, they lose the land, they lose the numbers. It all goes if they disobey. So everything hinges on whether they will obey or disobey God's commands. That is the big issue which is on the table for us now. Which will they do? Now, before we go any further and look at whether they obey or not, let me just pause for a moment to unwrap the Mosaic Covenant just a little bit more, because it is so important. Really, the Mosaic Covenant dominates the whole Old Testament, and it is very hard to understand the Old Testament from here on, and indeed quite hard to understand what Jesus came to do, without understanding the Mosaic Covenant. Remember yesterday, Nigel was saying that Jesus came to nail the demands of the Mosaic Covenant up, to get rid of them. Well, this is what it is that was up that he's having to get rid of, this fact that if they disobey, they get cursed. But let's just spell it out. You see, the conditions that God is laying down are not arbitrary conditions. God is not saying, you've got to be able to stand an egg pointy end up, or something like that, and only then will I fulfill all these covenants with you. Rather, the commands that God gives them, which they are to obey, fall into two big categories. One huge lump, I'll call it half, it may not be exactly half, but it's about that, of the commands, are about how Israel have to relate to God, how they should, their relationship with God. So the first four commands in the Ten Commandments are all about that. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall make no idols. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. They're all about how we relate, they relate to God. The other half of the Mosaic Covenant is all about how they relate to each other. And the second six of the Ten Commandments are all about that. You shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, you shall not murder. It's all about how they relate to each other. And if you just think about that, that's exactly what you'd expect, because they're being called out. God has rescued his people from Egypt, but he now wants them to be his people. And what should characterize God's people? Well, one of the things that should characterize God's people is that if they're God's people, they need to relate to God. So that's what half the laws are about. The other thing is, if they're a people being made into a nation, living in harmony together, they need to learn how to relate to each other. So the laws are actually all about fulfilling exactly what God is trying to accomplish. Yep. Yeah. Thanks. The answer is, when you look at a lot of the more apparently random commands, probably, but not certainly, because we don't have the certain information, probably a lot of them are about how we relate to God, because a lot of them are forbidding things that other people were doing as they worship their idols. So he's saying, you mustn't worship me in the way that other people are worshiping their idols. This is the way you're supposed to worship me. Now, that's true for some, there are others I just don't know the answer to yet. Any other questions at this point? We've galloped through this quite quickly. I can appreciate that people might be feeling a little bit bemused and lost. So this is your chance to say, hang on a minute, I don't understand. Can you explain again? Don't feel shy, because if you are confused, chance are four other people in this room are as well. Doesn't mean everybody's with me. Isn't that fantastic? Good. Okay, let's press on then. The reason, I've said that what happens in the Mosaic Covenant are that two new things happen in the Mosaic Covenant. One, the promises to Abraham are developed, and the other is that conditions are added. The reason that conditions are added, and that is so important, is because now God is beginning to do something, or to address the issue of the cause of the fall. If you remember when we looked at this yesterday, we said the first five things on that chart were all about God's judgment on them. This is what would happen because they had sinned. They'd lose the relationship, they'd lose the land, they'd die, etc. And the sixth of those was the one that caused the problem in the first place. Sin. In Abraham, God was just dealing with the result side. His judgment. And he was saying he was going to undo all that he'd judged, all that judgment, or he was going to begin to undo all that judgment. Now that he's actually begun to do that, and he's rescued them out of Egypt, he's saying, well, hang on a minute, before we can actually finish this process off, and I actually do reverse all that judgment, that sin that caused the problem in the first place, something needs to be done about that. And what he's done in the Mosaic Covenant is he's given Israel the responsibility for dealing with the sin side. So he said, right, let's split the workload. I'll do the bit of sorting out all the judgments that I've poured on you, the fact that you will die and lose the land, etc. And you do something about the bit that you caused in the first place, sin. It's something like this. Thank you. Sin is what caused the problem in the first place. It didn't just happen. Sin was what pushed us over the edge into the fall. But now that God has begun to rescue Israel from the fall, he says, yeah, but we've got to deal with that sin issue. And your job is to now to obey and stop rebelling. Problem is, of course, Israel doesn't do it. And very quickly after God gives Moses this covenant, Israel starts sinning. And so instead of obtaining all the promises God has promised, she now starts obtaining all those curses, all that judgment, all that, I will abhor you, I will destroy you, I will turn against you. Now, that should be really the end of the story. But God is a merciful God. So he doesn't destroy them all at once. He punishes, but he doesn't destroy. And also, he's got some important lessons he wants to teach and reveal through the Mosaic Covenant. And if he were just to destroy Israel like that, then he wouldn't have the time and the space to teach the lessons he wants to teach. So what he does is he punishes the sin, but not as much as it merits. He's merciful. He doesn't punish a lot of the sin. But he can't just ignore the sin. He can't just say, well, I'll choose not to punish it, so I'll pretend it hasn't happened. So what he does is he gives Israel the sacrificial system. Now, if you've ever tried reading the Bible through from the beginning, chances are the place you fell flat on your nose and stopped was when you hit Leviticus. When you get page after page after page of the sacrificial system. And this is the reason why. It's all there because God has looked at Israel sinning and said, well, I've got to punish you, but I don't want to completely destroy you. Here is the sacrificial system where if you offer an animal, I will punish the animal instead of you. And allow the things to continue. Does that make sense? The Mosaic Covenant is not a mistake. From what I've just said, you might think, well, why did God introduce the Mosaic Covenant in the first place then? Didn't he know that Israel would sin? Didn't he know that Israel couldn't do his bit, her bit? And the answer is, he knew perfectly well, and it's there within the Mosaic Covenant. He says to Moses, I am telling you that this is what you must do, but I know you will not do it. So you think then, why did you give it God if you know that they wouldn't do it? And the reason, God says, is because he's trying to teach them some very important lessons. Let me give you four lessons that God is teaching Israel through the Mosaic Covenant. First, God is teaching Israel through the Mosaic Covenant that sin needs to be dealt with before the promises can be fulfilled. If you hadn't got the Mosaic Covenant, you would know that that green sin needed to be dealt with. Now, because of the Mosaic Covenant, we do. The second important thing that God is teaching Israel through the Mosaic Covenant is that Israel can't do it herself. You see, God knows from the beginning that Israel can't obey, but Israel doesn't. When God gives the command, the first thing Israel says is, everything you've said we'll do. No problem. We'll do it. God has to show them that they can't. And one of the big lessons that the Mosaic Covenant does is to show them they cannot obey. Until they realize they cannot obey, they won't be ready for God doing it his way. The third thing that the Mosaic Covenant teaches us is something about sacrifice. Remember we said this animal sacrifice helped. It dealt with God's wrath. It propitiated God's wrath. It satisfied God's anger so that he didn't immediately destroy them. Well, an animal sacrifice doesn't do the full job, which is why God continues to punish them. But it's teaching us a lesson. If we had a sacrifice that was good enough, then maybe, just maybe, it might be good enough. Watch this space. And the fourth really important lesson the Mosaic Covenant teaches us is it teaches us something about God. He is a merciful God who will forgive even when they sin. even though he does have to punish. So he punishes the animal instead. Now that's just four lessons out of the Mosaic Covenant. Obviously, when we talk about 3.5 books of the Old Testament. The last one was, he's a merciful God. When we talk about 3.5 books out of the Old Testament, about 170 pages, for comparison, John is only about 25 pages, I think. There's a lot more there, but that just gives you some sort of feel of what's happening. Any questions at this point before we move off the Mosaic Covenant? Sophie happy? Sachi happy? Yeah.
Is that just a picture of God taking away sin, or is it really?
You do ask difficult questions. That's a very, very good question indeed. I think Yes, can I repeat the question for the tape? Is the animal sacrifice just a picture, or does it really do the job? I think at this point in time, it's portrayed as though it's doing the job. But with the benefit of hindsight, we know it's just a picture. An animal sacrifice cannot take away sin, says the New Testament. It needs something bigger. It's a picture of what God is doing. Yeah.
Was God in that deceiving the Israelites, thinking that if they were sacrificing this animal, they could then become
righteous with him? Was God deceiving Israel when he offered them the animal sacrifice then? Good question again. No, because what happens is that as a result of the animal sacrifice, they're not forgiven completely. They're not forgiven in the sense that they can't get into heaven. But they are forgiven to the extent that he doesn't destroy them right away. You see, under the terms of the Mosaic Covenant, one sin, and that's it. What's the American phrase, one strike and you're out, is it? Well, it was like that with the Mosaic Covenant. But the sacrificial system does at least say, no, you have chance after chance after chance. Israel will survive sinning against God despite the Mosaic Covenant for something like 600 years. That's an awful lot of second chances. So the sacrificial system at least allows that. It may not get you into heaven, it may not be a real forgiveness, but it's giving you 600 years worth of second chances.
At that time it was enough.
Exactly, thank you. At that time it was enough. Any other questions?
Just one quick one. In the Abrahamic those promises to other nations who
exist
between Israel. Does that come in at this point?
Nope. Hold fire till tomorrow for that one. Let's press on, shall we? If that's the main ones. Let's look then at what Israel's experience is in the first 250 years of the Mosaic Covenant. Because of Israel's sin, immediately after Mount Sinai, God condemns that generation of Israelites to die in the wilderness. So even though they've got the sacrificial system, they sin and 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 they sin 10 times. And in Numbers 14, God says, you've sinned against me 10 times and that's enough second chances for the time being. This generation is going to die in the wilderness. Your children will go into the promised land though. So 40 years after the Mosaic Covenant, Joshua, was Moses' successor, leads them into the promised land. And initially, things look quite promising. They go into the land and they conquer lots of enemies and it all looks brilliant. And as you read the first half of Joshua, you think this is it. And then it all goes wrong again. The wheels come off. And Israel keeps on sinning and so does not inherit what God has promised. She only ends up occupying some of the promised land. She doesn't have any peace. She doesn't have much blessing. And God remains hostile. Let me just read you one passage where you can see that summarized. Judges chapter 2. We're probably now moving into bits of the Bible, which most of us know very little about. You know, most of us can roughly get us up to Mount Sinai because we've watched Prince of Egypt or something like that. And then after Mount Sinai, before Jesus, we know there's this guy called David, but we're a bit hazy about everything else. So this is why it's going to be quite hard work this morning. Ask questions if you're unclear. But we're now in Judges, which is the book after Joshua. Judges chapter 2. Let's pick the story up at verse 10. After that whole generation, that's Joshua's generation, had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals, that's the idols. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreth. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them in the Mosaic Covenant. They were in great distress. Okay, that's the life of Israel in the Promised Land. That goes on for something like 200 years. That's a long time. 200 years ago, we were still fighting Napoleon. The reason for all this problem is sin. Until sin, that green thing, gets solved, this will continue. God will continue to punish until one day he punishes completely and brings them to an end. In this period, God gives us another clue as to what will help with a problem of sin. Remember we said sacrifices help. Now there's one other really important thing that will help, and that is a good leader. A leader like Moses got Israel out of Egypt and as far as he did. A leader like Joshua is what got them into the land. And in the period of the Judges, whenever all that we read in Judges 2 took place and they sinned, sometimes they'd repent, and when they repented, God would raise up a judge for them, a leader. And under that judge, things would get better again. So it slightly looked like this.
At this point, there is a short gap of just a few seconds in the original recording.
I ought to say that the judges all died, and after they died, things went back again. So that is what it looks like. We want to take that off as well. Okay, where you have a lot of zigzaggy bits over there. Up with Moses, down when they sin. Up with Joshua, down when they sin. And up and down with all of the judges, and as they sin, through the rest of their time in Canaan. And there's a general downward trend, because if you read the book of Judges, you'll see things get generally worse and worse. And the problem is, as you can see, that at the end of each leader's life, things go downhill. The leaders died, that's a problem. So they couldn't continue helping. How do you have a leader that continues forever? Well, one way of having a leader that continues forever is having a monarchy. So that when the king dies, his son and heir becomes king and leads. And the book of Judges ends with a verse which implies that a king will help. Look at the last verse in the book of Judges. Judges 21:25, where we see, verse 25. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. That's why it's all going wrong. That's why everybody's doing as they see fit and sinning, because there's no king. So maybe having a king will help. And that is the next big step forward in God's plan, a monarchy. The first king, Saul, was no great shakes, and nothing really much happens underneath him. But then under the next two kings, David and Solomon, Israel reaches her high point. Through them, God... Well, let's put the diagram up, and then we'll talk about it. Okay, so under the monarchy, it soars up. Things get vastly better than they have before. Under David, the land is conquered for the first time completely. Under David, for the first time, they have peace because he defeats all the enemies, inside and outside. Under Solomon, a temple is built for God, so he really can dwell with them all the time. And they have immense prosperity. things look good, don't they? You guessed it. They sin. Even those good kings sin. David sins. Most particularly, he sins with Bathsheba when he commits adultery with Bathsheba and then murders her husband. Solomon sins even worse because he marries lots of foreign women, non-Israelite women, who lead him into idolatry. So he sets up idols all around Jerusalem. But despite the fact that the kings sin and so they can't get all the way, the king is the way forward. And God therefore makes a promise to David that one of his descendants, one of the kings from the line of David, will eventually succeed in fulfilling all that he's promised. Does that make sense? Are people with me? Nigel, are you happy? Do you think we're with us? Good. Yep.
I thought that initially that God wasn't too keen on the idea of Israel having a monarchy. I thought that his family should ask a monarchy for like the nations.
Good.
And I also thought that initially the monarchy wasn't seen so much as a sort of blind king, but as the opposite of God willing to be king.
Let's take the first of those because it's the easier one of those two. At first, God doesn't looks as though he's not keen on the idea of kings, is the question. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, it does look as though God is not keen on the idea of kings, but 1 Samuel chapter 8 is not the beginning of the idea of kings. The idea of kings actually gets raised as early as Genesis chapter 17, when Abraham is told that he'll be the father of many kings. And the idea of kings runs through all those chapters long before the monarchy starts. The idea of kings come up. And every single time, pretty nearly, it's positive. This is a good thing that there's going to be a king. It's a good thing there's going to be a king. A king will do this for you and it's going to be good. The problem seems to be the specific details of 1 Samuel chapter 8, the way they're asking for a king there. The monarchy was meant to be a theocracy is the other question. In other words, God rules through the king. I don't think that's an either or. I think the monarchy was a succession, but also God was meant to rule through the king. That's why the king was going to be good, was because God was going to rule through the king. Any other questions? Okay, let's have a look then at what God promises David. The third covenant. You may think these covenants are going on forever. We've reached number three. Where are you going to stop, you think? The answer is there are only four major ones. So number three is three quarters of the way there. Again, the first three columns and the last column are exactly what we've seen up previously. It's a column headed David that you need to keep your eye on. That's the new one. Again, the print is getting smaller. If you can't see it, it's not too late to come to the front. So what does God promise David? Do Samuel chapter 7. We're now into seriously obscure bits of the Bible. And unfortunately, we all use different versions, so I can't even give you a page number. It's page 289 on mine, but I don't know whether that's any help to any of you. It's after 1 Samuel, and it's before 1 and 2 Kings, and it's before 1 and 2 Chronicles, and it's before the Psalms. It's about two books after Judges. Do Samuel chapter 7. What does God promise David? Well, actually what he promises David is all the same things as he's promised Abraham. And all the things he promised Moses he'd do if they obeyed. Same sorts of things. So, look at, also, there's one extra thing he promises David, and that is David will have a descendant, a king, who will sit on David's line. And this descendant is the one who will accomplish all that has been promised. So look at chapter 7, verses 12 and 13. When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So there's going to be this descendant, and he's going to build a house for God. Now, the important thing about a house for God is, remember we said that one of the highlights of the relationship God was going to have with Israel was he was going to dwell with them. We were going to have the Almighty God who made the heavens and the earth coming and living in the middle of them. Well, the house is basically his home, his place, his permanent abode, the place where he can be and not leave. And that God, this offspring is going to build that house. And this offspring is going to rule forever over the nation. And so through this offspring, Israel is going to have this relationship with God because he's going to put the house there. Also, through the offspring, you will see in verse 10 and 13, Israel is promised a home and peace and a kingdom. In other words, she's promised land, that's a home. She's promised blessing, that's peace and the idea of security which comes with home. And she's promised harmonious relationship, the idea of nation that comes with kingdom. Verse 10, then, let's just read it. I will provide a place for my people Israel and will plant them so that they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. Wicked people shall not oppress them any more as they did at the beginning, and have done ever since the time I appointed leaders over my people Israel. Verse 13, he is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So Israel will have this kingdom. If he's going to rule this kingdom, they will be this kingdom forever. Okay? So as you work down that list, you'll see relationship promised to Abraham. Yes, they're going to have a relationship. They'll have a God dwelling in them in a permanent house. Land. Yes, they'll have a land. It'll be their home. Blessing. Yes, they'll have blessing, they'll have peace, and the idea of a home with all the implications of home. The sort of thing they lost when they were thrown out of Eden. Numbers of people. Well, that's not strictly there, but I think it's implicit in the idea of being a kingdom that goes on forever, but that's a bit of a dodgy one, which is why there's a question mark there. They're going to be a kingdom. They're going to have that harmony implied by being a nation, a kingdom, living all together. And it will all happen because of the king who will help them not sin. Can you see the way that as each covenant goes on, a new idea is added? Abraham just had the idea of the judgment then being dealt with. Moses has the idea of sin being dealt with, even if Israel has to do it. David has the idea of the king who will help them deal with the sin, the king who's going to lead towards the Christ who's going to be on the throne. The thing we've been looking for, we said yesterday that in the Garden of Eden at the fall, there was no real indication there was going to be a king. There's no reversal of that. Well, now there is. We have a promise to David of a king who will rule forever, which is obviously going to be Christ in the new creation. The Abrahamic covenant will be fulfilled through the Davidic king. Everybody happy with that? Yes.
On the point of the Hebrews and numbers not being mentioned.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm completely wrong, but I believe the Hebrew for house is the same as the Hebrew for household.
Yes, it is.
And so in verse 13, he is the one who will build a household for my name, might imply that he's creating numbers of people.
Possible. But, yeah, that is possible. It's like in the English language, where house can mean dynasty, or it can mean a building. So it's household in the sense of dynasty. It could mean lots of people. Possible is the answer. I think you know, because you've all been studying John and Romans and books like that, and you did 1 Corinthians this morning, you know how much richness there is in any little bit of the Bible. We have just whistled through 500 pages of it in the last half an hour. Well, perhaps not that much, 300 pages in the last half an hour. There is an awful lot of detail and richness still there. I hope that what we're doing in this exercise is just giving you a skeleton, the thinnest of thin skeletons, which will just entice you to go back and read it and study it for yourself and just see how much more richness there is there, still waiting to come out. Any other questions before we move on? Sorry, was that anything? Okay, let's press on. Let's go back to the storyline. What happens to Israel under the Mosaic Covenant? Remember, we're still in this difference between the blue line and the black line. They are still... Let's go back to this diagram. The monarchy might have helped them enormously, but it still hasn't got them there. The Davidic covenant is going to make things worse because we've got the blue line is going to go up a little bit. What is Israel actually going to experience under it? Is the black line underneath the kings going to come up and reach the blue line? Or isn't it? Remember, that's the challenge. There are two things we're looking for. The blue line to go up towards the new creation, and the black line to meet the blue line. Well, the blue line is doing quite well so far. It's going up and up and up. The black line is bouncing all over the place. Some ups, some downs. And the Davidic covenant is no different. It's a promise for the future. Israel's experience in practice under her kings, David, Solomon, and the ones that followed, was very, very far from what God is promising. David and Solomon, as I said, both sinned, and their successors also sinned, and they sinned big time. And as we work through the books of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, if you've ever read those, you will come across king after king after king. The first time I read it, I was bored to tears. You probably were as well. And if you haven't, you will be if you don't know what you're letting yourself in for. Because you come across a king, and Bloggins became king of Israel, and Bloggins sinned. And Bloggins 2 became king of Israel, and Bloggins sinned. And Bloggins 3 became king of Israel, and Bloggins sinned. And the reason for all of that is we're going through the kings looking, is this the one who is promised to David? Is this the offspring who's going to bring about the fulfillment? And the answer, king after king after king, is no, not this one. No, not this one. But because of all the sin, God doesn't just sit there waiting. God punishes sin, as he must. Yes, the animal sacrifices were helping, but they aren't enough. They're not doing the whole job. And so God punishes sin. And Israel begins to lose all she had. And this is what it looks like. Oops. Okay? So the blue line goes up with David. But the black line goes down and down and down. And it goes down in three great catastrophes. Let me run you through 400 years of history of Israel in 2 minutes. Over the next 350 years really of history, we have three great disasters which afflict Israel. Immediately after Solomon's reign, the kingdom of Israel splits into two. They had so little harmony, they actually had a civil war and split into two. The northern kingdom, which is called Israel, and the southern kingdom, which is called Judah. And those two never come together again in the history of the Bible. They remain separate. First great catastrophe. You now don't have one kingdom, you've got two. And they spend a lot of time fighting against each other. Catastrophe number two comes 200 years after that, when Assyria, which is a superpower in the area, begins to attack Israel. Now, some of you will have heard the series we did on Isaiah, which was written at the time that Assyria came and attacked Israel. And what happens in the end is Assyria conquers the northern kingdom, Israel, and takes that northern kingdom away into exile. And that northern kingdom is taken into exile and scattered and lost and disappears off the map. Never found again, never features in the rest of the Bible as a historical unit. Israel disappears at the Assyrian exile. What is left is a southern part of the original kingdom called Judah. And if you read your Bible, from this point onwards, sometimes it's called Judah, and sometimes it's called Israel, because it's all that's left of the big original country of Israel. And 150 years after that, the southern kingdom of Israel is taken into exile also. Now, in that 150 years, the superpower of Assyria fell away, and another superpower, Babylon, rose up in the air in the Middle East instead. So the southern kingdom of Judah is taken into exile in Babylon, a different exile. As a result of those three great disasters that befell Israel, by that exile of Judah to Babylon, we have God's temple destroyed, because that's what the Babylonians did. They burnt Jerusalem down, completely destroyed the temple, everything in it. Israel has lost her land. She's scattered and taken into exile. There is no blessing. I mean, obviously there's no blessing if you're scattered as slaves in somebody else's land. Many of the people have been killed in all the wars that took place, and Israel has ceased to be a kingdom. Remember when we said, looked at the Mosaic Covenant, we said that if they disobeyed, God would take away all those blessings? Well, that's just what he's done by the exile, which is why they're back at where they were. The black man is back where it was when they were slaves in Egypt. In fact, in some ways, it's worse. They've lost it all. It looks pretty bleak, and it's sin, that green line, which is driving it apart. The important thing to notice is it looks pretty bleak, but God's plan is still on track. God, that blue line is still up there. God has promised that. And the promise to Abraham and the promise to David are unconditional. Whatever's happening to Israel, however much she sins, God will find some way or other, by hook or by crook, God will fulfill those promises. Because that blue line depends on God, not us, not Israel, not anyone else. So Israel is going through a pretty torrid time, but God will find some way of solving it and fulfilling what he has promised, that blue line. And so, in this situation where everything is going so horribly wrong, God speaks again. And he speaks in this situation through the prophets. Now the exile, which is where we are, is probably the most important historical event in the whole Old Testament. It is one that most Christians today are very, very ignorant of. I was certainly ignorant of it for many years as a Christian. I think many Christians still are. It is the most important historical event in the Old Testament. 45%, almost half of the Old Testament was written at or around the exile. Without understanding something about the exile, we won't understand Jesus. Because half the Old Testament, which points us to Jesus, is at the exile. And yet it's the bit we know so little about. Now, one of the things the prophets were saying at the time of the exile is this judgment is going to come, that this is going to happen. But the other big thing the prophets were saying at the time of the exile is God really is committed to his promises, and this is what he's going to do. And we're focusing on the promise line. So we're going to spend 5 minutes in pairs just looking at some of what God promised through the prophets at the time of the exile. But before we do that, are there any questions before we split into pairs? The answer is, I mean both. When I say that the exile is the most important, and God, 45% of the Bible is written at the time of the exile, it's both exiles put together. They may be split by a period of 150 years, but in God's plan, it's really one event as the whole big nation gets sent off in different directions. Is that a finger? Yep. Everybody else happy? Any other questions? This is your chance. Okay. Now, this, you'll be pleased to know, is not halfway through, because we don't have that amount of time. Let's just spend 4 minutes in our pairs looking at the following two passages. Ezekiel 37, verses 24 to 28, and Ezekiel 34, verses 25 to 30. And what I want you to do, and don't cheat because this is on the back, the last side of the handout, so you could cheat if you wanted and looked at that. But just have a quick look at that in your pairs and see what God is promising and how it compares with all those areas that we've had up. All these areas. Ezekiel 37 and 34. Let's just spend 4 minutes doing that. I'm sorry, that's just look at my watch. We don't have time, so I'm going to guillotine us there. Hopefully, you've just begun to give you a feel for the way the answers are just sitting there, jumping out in the right passages. I won't take feedback again because of time. Let's just run through the way that everything which is... That's David. That's not the one I want. There we are. There's a promise of a new covenant sitting there. In summary, in nutshell, you find that everything that was promised to Abraham and to David gets re-promised in the new covenant, plus some really big additions. So let's just run through it and have a look at those quickly. Starting from the top of that table, just focus on the column marked new and just run down it. First of all, they will have a relationship with God. They will be God's people. He will be their God. Chapter 27, verse 27. Chapter 37, verse 27. My dwelling place will be among them. I will be their God, and they will be my people. Remember that was what was promised? Here comes that again. So it looked as though everything was going horribly wrong, didn't it? At this time, they're just going into exile. The bottom has dropped out of the world. The black line has gone as far down as it's going to go. And God says, my dwelling place will be among them, and they will be my people. It's re-promised. They're promised their own land. Chapter 37, verse 25. They live in the land I gave to my servant Jacob, the land where your fathers live. They and their children and their children's children will live there forever. They will have that land again. But, and this doesn't come within this passage, but it comes within the prophets, the land that they're going to have isn't just the land of Canaan. This is the really important thing. The land that God is now promising them is nothing less than the new creation itself. Let's just have a look at that. Flip back two books to Isaiah. Last bit of Isaiah. Isaiah is another prophet writing at the time of the exile. Isaiah chapter 65, verse 17 to 25. God's saying what he's going to do. Behold, I will create new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create, for I will create Jerusalem to be a delight, and its people a joy. I will rejoice over Jerusalem and take delight in my people. The sound of weeping and of crying will be heard in it no more. Never again will there be in it an infant that lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. He who dies at 100 will be thought a mere youth. He who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed. They will build houses and dwell in them. They will plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build houses and others live in them, or plant and others eat. For as the days of a tree, so will the days of my people. My chosen ones will long enjoy the works of their hands. They will not toil in vain, nor bear children doomed to misfortune. For they will be a people blessed by the Lord, and they and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are still speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb will lie down together. The lion will eat straw like the ox, but dust will be the serpent's food. They will neither harm nor destroy in all my holy mountain. Keep a finger in Isaiah. We'll need to come back to there again. But do you see the way that God is actually promising not just a land, but a restoration of a new creation in which even lions and lambs lie down together, in which nothing will destroy anything in all the holy mountain God's going to make. We're back to Eden. You get the promise back to Ezekiel 34, and you get the promised blessings mentioned. Ezekiel 34, 26. God says, I will bless... Sorry, I'll wait for the rustle of pages to mean people have got to Ezekiel 34, 26. I will bless them and the places surrounding my hill. I will send down showers in season. There will be showers of blessing. Etc., etc. You can read the rest for yourself. But God will bless them. Again, they're promised large numbers, just like Abraham was. They will have the many descendants. Ezekiel 37, 26. 37, 26. I will make a covenant of peace with them. It will be an everlasting covenant. I will establish them and increase their numbers, and I will put my sanctuary among them forever. But again, just like the new creation, when they were promised the land, but actually God is saying at this time, it's not just Canaan, it's a new creation. So were the many people. They promised many descendants. But now for the first time, remember, the original problem wasn't not enough descendants. The original problem was death. And at this time, God is saying he's going to deal with death as well. Isaiah 25. Isaiah 25, verses 7 and 8. On this mountain, this holy mountain that God is about to make, on this mountain he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all people, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away tears from all faces. He will remove the disgrace of his people from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. So death itself is going to be abolished in this new covenant. Harmony is implied. It's less clear. I'll leave it to you there. All this, give me 30 seconds and we'll go for lunch. All this will definitely happen because these promises are unconditional. And God says at this time in Ezekiel that he will actually deal with the problem of sin himself. So Ezekiel 36, 25 to 27. Ezekiel 36, 25 to 27, he says, I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. I will cleanse you from all your impurities and from all your idols. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. So that's what he's going to do. He's going to give us new hearts and a spirit, and he's going to cleanse us so that we obey. So again, that is completely different. And finally, that king, oh, we won't look it up because we know it so well, particularly at this time of year, but in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, we're told that that king will be called Everlasting God, Almighty Father, or Everlasting Father, Almighty God. He said that is what's being promised in this new covenant, a complete reversal of everything that went wrong in the fall. It looks like that. You get a complete reversal for the first time. We're right up there with the blue line. And it is more than what was promised at the fall, because they're promised this king now, who will be David. And they're promised that God will deal with sin. Now, we'll pick that diagram up tomorrow. So if you don't can't absorb it all right away, don't worry. We'll pick it up from there tomorrow. Let's go for lunch. And if anybody has questions, call me afterwards. Let's just pray very briefly before we go. Father God, thank you for the richness of your word. Thank you for how much there is in there. Help us, Father, as we try to absorb and take on board all that you have said in your word. Help us to get really excited by it and not daunted, but really look forward to the time that you will fulfill all those promises. In Jesus' name, amen.